Good morning. Welcome to the Job Growth, Energy, Affordability, Policy, and Finance Committee. Today is Friday, April 19th. No, 20th. Friday, April 20th. First order of business is approval of the minutes. Representative Dabney moves approval of the minutes dated March 18th. Is there any corrections, changes, or additions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Say nay. Motion carries. Next is updated the minutes from April 19th. Representative Howe moves approval of the minutes dated April 19th. Any corrections, changes, or additions? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Before we get started, I just want to thank our pages and staff for the exceptional work this legislative session, running around and keeping us as organized as we can be. So thank you very much for your work this session. On behalf of all the members, we greatly appreciate your work.
Yeah.
So members, what we're going to do now, the chair is going to move House File 4289 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. In order to get that bill in front of us, I need to move the delete all amendment. This is the research summary that will, that your research summary is conformed to the delete all amendment and the one that the amendments will work from. So this is to get the bill in the form I would like. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The delete all is now in front of us. Members, the first amendment we're going to take up here is the... Oh, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. I just wanted to take a minute to thank Chair Garofalo for allowing me to be part of this committee for the last 4 years. And for the good work that we've done. I also did not get a chance to do this yesterday. I also want to reach out and say thank you to Chair Fabian. You guys, you're amazing. You really are. And I want to say thank you for that. I had two choices this morning as I was driving down the freeway. I could stop and huddle amendments with my caucus, or I could stop and get donuts. I got donuts.
You made the
so I want to say thank you, and please eat these because I can't digest them all.
Thanks, buddy.
All right, thank you, Representative Neuberger.
And I do not have any amendments in here, so I'm not trying to donut anybody up.
Okay, so members, the first amendment we're going to take up, Representative O'Neill. Go ahead if you want to move your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the A14 amendment.
All right, Representative O'Neill moves the A14 amendment. And Representative O'Neill, I think obviously members of the committee, I think, are familiar with your amendment, but if you want to do a quick walkthrough of it, and then we'll have discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is the bill, House File 3708, about nuclear power and the PUC. We had a almost three-hour robust conversation on Monday night. We have some of the same stakeholders that are here in the room. I don't have my Monticello people, but you heard their concerns. If I was going to simplify this bill, of course it's not simple, but in the simple terms, it creates an advanced determination of prudence. It takes what happens now after the fact, after Xcel Energy has already spent all of their money to do their capital investments, brings it to the PUC. This would do an advanced determination of prudence to decide, are those expenditures going to be prudent? So it has a full and robust conversation before they go out and spend the money on capital investment for nuclear. And that is what the bill does. I've had multiple conversations with the Chamber of Commerce, and they have not been able to come to any agreement as far as language change. So the amendment you see in front of you is the same, with the exception of I did include Representative Clark's request. So it does have the request of having the Prairie Island and the Monticello community specifically named in the bill. So, Representative Clark, I have that in there for you. Otherwise, it is as we discussed for 3 hours on Monday evening.
Thank you, Representative Neal. Discussion to the amendment. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I was not here on Monday.
Representative Mahoney, can you pull the mic closer to you? Thank you.
Sure. I apologize. I was not here on Monday. I was trying to convince a brother-in-law whose 90th birthday we were celebrating that he should live to 100 just to irritate his wife. But can I get a just a brief view from what this is doing from Representative O'Neill. I was having such a good time with my pneumonia in California that I did not follow much of anything. So if the author of the amendment would briefly talk about what it does.
Sure. And Representative O'Neill, I know we generally do not allow public testimony at the final hearing for the omnibus bill, but if you want to phone a friend, that's fine too. But Representative O'Neill, I know you know the bill, so Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney. Sir, Xcel Energy is more than welcome to come down and offer any other comments that they would like. So if Rick Evans wants to come back down, that would be fine. Representative Mahoney, it simply puts, it shifts the burden from after they expend all of that capital investment. So right now, as you know, UC does determinations of prudence after the money is spent. This would shift it to before the money is spent. And so they would have the full and robust conversation before they spend the money, whether or not these expenditures are prudent. And that is what the bill does, Representative Mahoney.
So if Mr. Evans wants to come forward, he can cover the individual subdivisions for. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. I think Representative O'Neill explained the, and I couldn't completely hear the question, so there may be an additional question that she didn't answer, but what she explained was is the case that currently the PUC analyzes prudence in the rate case process before these investments are put into our rates. What we're asking for is an analysis of the prudence of these expenditures before we spend the money based on a detailed budget that we would file with them. And then when in a subsequent rate case, when we came in, as long as we came in under the budget that had been approved, there would be no further examination of prudence. So that, and essentially giving us the comfort when we're making the investments that we've already met with our regulators and received approval for the expenditures up to the limit that we have proposed.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now I understand what we're doing here. So I'm going to build a base for the question, then I'll ask the question. Nuclear power plants, you cannot have an accident. Just there is no room for error in power in nuke plants, both for human cost and money, environment, PR for nothing else. So this says if you come in under budget, what happens if, I've worked at nuclear plants, there's always one thing that goes unplanned, shows up unplanned. So what happens if you go over budget?
Mr. Evans.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, so there's a couple of things that could happen in the process. So let's say we propose this budget and it's been deemed to be prudent by the Public Utilities Commission. Under the bill, we come back in every 2 years to let the PUC know how we're doing toward our budget, and they're empowered to make whatever orders they need to make to protect ratepayers in those reviews. If we see prior to our next rate case that we are going to exceed our budget, we have the opportunity to come back in and say we think we're going to go over our budget. But at that point, the PUC would have the same discretion to say yay or nay to any prudency for the additional amount. If we came to the rate case and presented spending in excess of the budget that we had proposed back in this new process that we're proposing, we would have to show, we would have to defend our budget or defend the excess to the PUC. We would at that point obviously be over the budget that we had proposed and present a fairly high burden of proving that was prudent. This is the same as what happened under the current case, except that in the current case they wouldn't have the budget that we had presented before.
And thank you. So any discussion? Thank you, Mr. Evans. That's it. So Representative Dabney, I don't want to for obvious reasons, we did have an over 3-hour hearing on this, so I thought out of deference to Representative Mahoney.
Understood.
So Is there any additional questions?
I'll let Mr. Evans go.
Yes, okay.
But, you know.
To the bill. To
yes,
the amendment.
To the amendment.
To the amendment,
thank
Representative Dabney.
You know, as I'm hearing this, I also was not able to be here on Monday. I believe I was in a separate committee. I hear Representative O'Neill use the word prudence, and I heard Mr. Evans, who shall not be spoken of after this, use the word prudence, and I think about the process where they expend costs without knowing whether the PUC is going to find all of those costs prudent. So there's a positive downward pressure on excess costs because you don't want to spend it if you're not going to get it back. And you're talking about removing that positive pressure for prudent expenditures from the system. And just to your community, Representative O'Neill, the last time they upgraded the facility in Monticello, they went $400 million over cost, which is a different definition of prudent than I think most Minnesotans would accept. Because I don't think $400 million over cost qualifies as prudent expenditures. And it was ratepayers who have to pay that. So Xcel comes forward, and they want less accountability to the public and more costs then shifted to the ratepayers when they don't act prudently. So I guess after that I would urge a no vote on the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill, I guess to the bill and to the amendment, which is meant to help Xcel, you know, meet the 85% carbon-free goals, which is great, right? We want that to happen. But it really only addressed really a small sliver of that vision while ignoring a bigger part of that. And thinking about this bill, you know, it really doesn't do anything to guarantee that workers or the community are taken care of. We don't know. The bill doesn't even guarantee that the plant will stay open. And even after billions of investment, the plant could close early, leaving workers without jobs and the community without tax payments, even at Xcel pay raters. Had to pick up that tab, as Representative Dabney just talked about. That could happen. And so I'm just wondering, why does this need to happen in 2018? Why now?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Moran. First, I wanted to address just a little bit of what Representative Dabney said, and then I'm going to come back to Representative Moran. But I think that it's important for the entire committee to remember what was happening when Monticello was under its retooling. They went out, they had their IRP, so they went out for their integrated resource plan. They had a preliminary budget within that, what they thought that this, you know, retooling and they were going to increase their capacity, what they thought that was going to cost. Then Fukushima happened. Then the NRC stepped in and said, you must do X, Y, Z and all the way to the moon. I mean, they had tremendous expenditure increases because of the Fukushima disaster. And yes, they did have cost overruns, but let me explain one thing, that if this bill passes and if they had done their advanced determination of prudence and they had come to an agreement through this robust process ahead of time, and then something like a Fukushima happened and they had to do all of this additional work to comply with federal regulations, they would be on the hook to prove that they are now prudent for those expenditures. The burden would be shifted fully back to Xcel Energy to prove that these expenses were in fact prudent. There would be no guarantee that they would have any of that covered. Now, in the PUC's wisdom, they were found prudent in the rate case, but not in there. You know that they're also allowed a certain amount of profits, so that's also regulated. Xcel Energy's profits are also regulated, so they weren't able to connect or be compensated for these overages in their profit margin. but yes, it went into the rate because it was completely and utterly outside of their control. It was outside of anything that could have been foreseen. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about Monticello. Now back to Representative Moran. It's not up to Xcel Energy whether they keep a plant open or not. That's a regulatory decision. The PUC will decide in the IRP process, in the Integrated Resource Plan process, whether or not this plant or some other plant stays open and for how long. And as you all know, the PUC in their latest letter to Xcel Energy said, oh, by the way, we want you to come up with an integrated resource plan for early closure, not on-time closure, but early closure of all of your aging baseload. We want a plan for closure at end of licensure. We want one that would be extended. So this is something that the PUC is already thinking about and looking at. This isn't an Xcel Energy decision. But if they have these conversations of prudency, and so prudency of Representative Dabney is, prudency is the word that the PUC uses to determine whether or not an expenditure has been properly sent. So if they're going to determine prudency ahead of time and there is something that happens, it's on Xcel Energy. They have to then prove that they actually spent prudently after the fact.
Representative Moran?
Mr. Chair, Representative. So why does it need to happen now in 2018, especially when, given that it's going to be very controversial? And so why not give the stakeholders in the summer and the fall to work on this, and, you know, the legislature will be back before the next, before Xcel next resource plan is filed. Why not? Why not wait?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Moran. Thank you for reminding me of that additional question. So why now? I think it's important because it was very recently, in recent memory, that the PUC did ask Xcel Energy to say, give us an integrated resource plan of early closure of all of your aging baseload plants. That kind of changes the dynamic. That's the PUC saying, all right, we need to really look seriously at costs. And so we are not only looking at this particular provision, Representative Moran, we are also looking at things like what Representative Cal Barr is doing and trying to reduce the CASC fees going forward. Because as we found out yesterday, if you look at their entire investment, so all of their capital investment over the next 43 years of their reactor life. So if you take the three reactors and see how much life they have left, that's 43 years. And if you divide that back by what they sort of, you know, back of the napkin estimated what's going to cost for capital investment, it's somewhere between $32.5 and $27.9 million per reactor per year. And it's interesting to note that $32 million per year goes into the RDA. So that's an additional tax on ratepayers. So if we're concerned about the ratepayer, we should have a real and honest conversation about what Representative Cal Barr is doing with reducing the CASC payments. So why now? It's because the PUC has said, hey, you know what? We need to look at possible early closure of all of these baseload plants. And by the way, as you duly noted, the nuclear power plants are carbon-free emissions. And if we're going to get to that 85% goal, then they need to be a part of the portfolio.
President Moran, any follow-up?
One last question, Mr. Chair. So Representative Neal, so if Minnesota Power or Otter Tail come to the legislature next year seeking an advanced determination of prudency for one of their projects, would you support it?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Moran. I haven't really thought about that. This is so specific to the nuclear fleet because they are so close to the end of their licensure. You know, in utility terms, it's 12 years for Monticello, 15 and 16 for Fair Island. It would be a conversation I'd be willing to have. I haven't thought about that before, so I really can't give you an honest answer. I haven't thought about it.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would like to speak a little bit to the what Representative Dabney brought up and maybe put a little different twist to it. We heard, you know, it is important that there are not any accidents ever at a nuclear plant. And so do we really, really want to put a lot of pressure on them to keep the costs way down? I think it is better to say, let's look ahead. Let's see what the potential costs are to protect this plant and say, yes, this will be a prudent cost so that you do it, rather than them saying, I'm not sure if we really should do this, and then you have an accident because they did not. So I think, and I think Representative Moran, your question, I would absolutely be in favor of this for all. I mean, this is what we do in all of construction. You look at what the costs are going to be before you undertake the construction, and you determine, do we want to do it all, or maybe the cost comes in lower, we can do more, it was in too high, we got to scale back. I mean, that's what you do. I think looking at this before you expend the money just absolutely makes sense, and I would be more than happy to do this for all cases for our energy people, because I think that's how you spend your money the wisest, when you're looking at it before you spend rather than after.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like so many things about this bill, because I really believe that we need baseload power in our plans in the future. And we've got two power plants right now that are doing that, and they're doing a good job of it. So I like the idea of baseload. I certainly like the idea of strategic, because these aren't little things that are being done. We're talking billion or better dollars here. So to look a little farther out and have a little more assurance if shareholders are going to make that investment makes complete sense to me. And I like the safeguards in the amendment relative to changes going forward, because if indeed there are cost overruns, it basically goes back into the process and has to be proved out that it made sense. I still, though, have a concern with the initial proposal that's going to be drawn up, because I don't see any objective controls in this bill that are going to keep the proposal down in cost. If I'm, as a business person, looking at these rules, my instincts would be to make sure that the project was as large as possible to give me a little wiggle room in case it doesn't work. And I don't begrudge the power company from doing that, but by the same token, my feeling has been, as I said the other night, is that we need some controls in here relative to that initial proposal. And the only thing that's really doing that right now is the PUC, and I'm not suggesting they won't do a good job, but there's so many dynamics going on here and so many different things happening that that's the issue that I have with the amendment or with the bill, is that we really don't have a way of controlling that initial proposal. And I'm certainly open to any discussion on that, but I don't know where that comes from. And again, I'm not suggesting that there's anything wrong going on. It's just a conflict between the entity that would be putting together the proposal and the customers who are going to pay for it.
Mr. Chair, may I speak to that point, please?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Vogel. I just wanted to point out an inaccuracy in what you had just said, and I appreciate your candor. It's not just the PUC. It is a full public input. So the Minnesota Chamber, the big power consumers, they are all at the table looking at those numbers as they are right now after the fact. And so there is tremendous public input in this entire process of the advanced determination of prudence. So it's not just the PUC's burden. It's it is a tremendously robust process. It is now. It would be, if this changed, it just would be done before they spend it instead of after. So I just wanted to point that out, that it's not just the PUC that is looking at all of these expenditures. The other thing I would say, too, is if you understand, it's almost an 18-month process for a rate case. It is incredibly comprehensive. They look at every single thing. They have a track record for years and years and years and years of what are appropriate expenditures for our nuclear plants. There is a base of knowledge that is unbelievable already out there. So they certainly, I don't think Xcel Energy can come in with inflated costs and you know, blow smoke or whatever, because there is so much data already there that is in the hands of the PUC, and as well as the chamber who will come in and you know, go back and forth in this whole process and have public input. So it is a very robust process. It is a very long process. There is an incredible amount of data that's already there to look at, are these expenditures prudent or not? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, Representative, and I think Representative O'Neill, if there's future rebuttals you wish to offer, we'll just wait for the closing statement. Okay. So, Representative Baker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I was two comments, maybe one. Just because of the absence of Representative Mahoney and Davini before, I wanted to know if, Mr. Chair, you would allow the chamber to have that very short comment on the other side, only because it reflects, I think, a good other side of that, and then I would have a comment after that. But if you don't want to do that, that's fine. I just wanted to throw that out there because I felt that was a good part of our great conversation we had on Monday.
Well, two things, Representative Baker. I don't think I'm going to because, number one, the chamber did actually testify yesterday at the hearing. And second of all, knowing those who are opposed to this, I know they've done a great job reaching out to every member, telling them what they feel about this already. And if they haven't, then I'm sorry.
Then that's fine.
And first of all, Representative Vogel, were you done with your questions? I didn't mean to leave you earlier. Did you have another question or a comment?
Just short, yes.
So, Representative Baker, apparently I cut off Representative Vogel and didn't realize it. So, Representative Vogel.
And I sat in a higher chair, so I'd be recognizable. And Mr. Chair, just a comment relative to that, and I'm not trying to minimize the approval process here. What I'm looking at is a company that basically the shareholders are paid relative to the asset base that they have in their control, and to me, it just leads to somewhat of an inherent conflict there, and I brought this up when we heard the bill and just wanted to explain that again, that I like this bill. It's just that I continue to have those reservations relative to the conflicting interests and how it eventually will play out. So,
Representative Baker.
Thank you. I think, again, I want to maybe circle back to Representative Rarick's comments, too, and maybe how Representative O'Neill didn't know how to respond to that question. What if the other investor-owned utilities did this more in advance, prudent question? And I think I would really have kind of a problem with that. Because I think in that industry, we know baseload coal, probably more predictable, we've got more history with that. Where I saw this a little differently with nuclear is because there has been some global issues that have come up that have made us recognize this a little differently. And this is a tough issue. I think for me, I'm still having a hard time with this bill because I do love nuclear. I think it's a great a base power plan. I want to see the plan continue to its license fully if it can, and maybe even beyond that. But I do know that I get nervous when we allow companies to sort of do some rounding up. And that's what has my concern about the ratepayers and the comfort level then shareholders have versus the ratepayers when it comes to that rounding methodology. That's the part that I'm having the most conflict with, I think, here too. So I'm glad we're having this conversation. I think it's a fabulous bill for the most part, but I can see where this is going to be something that doesn't have the same teeth as it would if it was done the other way. So I just wanted to make that on statement. Thanks.
Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, what I've learned over the last 6 years of serving in this body is that oftentimes we get really caught up in trying to create perfect. And we strive to create perfect, and perfect doesn't exist. You'll never have a perfect anything this side of eternity. It's just not going to happen. But I'm not going to let perfect get in the way of really good. And this is really good. I support this because at the end of the day, what this bill will do is it puts us one step further forward into guaranteeing some regulatory certainty with a PUC that has a long-time reputation of not offering regulatory certainty. We need to bring some certainty back to this equation, and I think that this bill is a good bill. And I think it takes a step in the right direction. Is it a perfect bill? No. But it's a good one. And it moves the ball in the direction that we need to go. So thank you, Representative O'Neill, for bringing this forward.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think one thing we sometimes lose track of here is that nuclear power is clean power. It's something that we all feel is important. And I also think that one of the reasons this is such a hard debate is, you know, natural gas has become so cheap that there's a question of is nuclear as efficient as natural gas, for example. And right now it probably isn't because the price of natural gas is so low. But again, these plants are scheduled to run for 12, 13, 15 years, And that's a long time in terms of commodity markets. And if we had any assurance that natural gas would be as cheap as it is 10, 15 years down the road, I think that would make a difference in how much we want to promote these extensions. But we can't make that assurance. And because of that, I think the power companies need a diverse portfolio of baseload power. This, I think, would help do that. So that is also why I support this bill.
Okay. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this has been a really difficult discussion to have, and it's a complicated issue. And I respect people on both sides of the arguments here, and so it's really difficult to make the decision. I do have one question for Representative O'Neill, if I might, Mr. Chair, and that is, under the current process, if there are cost overruns and Xcel Energy goes back to the PUC and said, you know, we need to be, we need a rate increase to compensate us for these cost overruns. What is the current process that they go through now? Let me rephrase that. What are their options with the PUC if they're denied the ability to raise the rates for cost overruns?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott. So, let me back up just for a minute. So when you say cost overruns, I know we're talking about the Monticello Nuclear Power Plant and when they were, you know, increasing their capacity. So they, in their IRP process, they just have a very kind of broad number of what they think it's going to cost, and that is what the PUC looked at and said, well, you said it was going to cost in this ballpark, and so it, what it actually cost was more than that. What happens right now is the entire, all of the expenditures, whether they're close to what they had anticipated, sort of a ballpark figure in their IRP, whether it's that or if it's more, all of it is under the rate case. Again, that takes about 18 months or so, and it's incredibly robust. So that's what happens right now is they look at all of the expenses after they've already been made and said, you know, were these prudent or were they not? What happened in the Monticello case, again, was they were credited for all of the expenses because it was, you know, the NRC coming and saying you need to spend all this extra money. It was included in the rate case. It was not included. They couldn't take a profit off of that. So the percentage of profit that they were allowed was reduced. So the shareholders did not receive anything. In this case, they would have this conversation in advance to say, here's the budget, this is what we, and then it would be an incredibly detailed budget. They would have that conversation before.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so when they made the previous upgrades, because they were basically ordered to do so, and they didn't prevail in the rate case, could they not have gone and sued the PUC and taken them to court to make their justification before, if you will, a higher court, a higher authority?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Scott, yes, I believe that they could have done that, but I would like to just check in with Xcel just to make sure that I am correct, but I believe that they could have gone to a court after that.
Representative Scott.
I see Mr. Evans is coming forward here to answer that question. Sorry.
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do have appeal to findings by the Public Utilities Commission. I certainly am not aware of it ever happening, but there is in the statutes an ability to appeal their decision.
Thank you. Representative Scott?
And I guess I feel like there's a way for them to address issues like this already, I guess, in current statute. And so I feel like this bill puts the legislature in a really tough spot when there's already something in statute that gives them at least the prospect of a remedy. So that's one of my concerns with the bill. Thank you, Mr.
Any additional discussion? Representative O'Neill, any closing comments before we vote?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just gave a little more thought to what Representative Moran had said, and why now it's important, too, is we do have the IRP, so the Integrated Resource Plan is due in February of 2019. And so, you know, a lot of things are factored into that. And this would be one thing that would help, you know, you had asked about the nuclear plant staying open and the jobs staying there. This would be one thing that would help them to have more surety moving forward. It would help to keep the nuclear plants open and functioning. And I think it's really important to have a diverse portfolio. I know that there were a couple comments about how important that is, that, you know, we don't have any surety of what gas is going to be, and we just don't have those sureties either. It's important to have a diverse portfolio, and this would be a great step forward to assure that they can get to their 85% of carbon reduction moving forward. So I appreciate the robust discussion, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Devney.
Given the interesting comments and apparent support and concern bipartisanly, I think it would be interesting to have a roll call on this.
Roll call has been requested.
Thank you.
The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Garofalo?
Pass.
Representative Neuberger?
Aye.
Representative Mahoney?
Aye.
Representative Clark?
No.
Representative Wagenius?
No.
Okay. Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Farr?
Yes.
Representative Baker?
No.
Representative Dabney?
No.
Representative Fabian?
No.
Representative Howe?
Aye.
Representative Lehman?
Aye.
Representative McQuaid? Representative Metza?
Pass.
Representative Moran?
No.
Representative Munson?
Aye.
Representative New?
Aye.
Representative O'Neill?
Yes.
Representative Rarick?
Yes.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Sundin?
Yes.
Representative Thiessen?
He's not on the committee anymore.
Sorry, I still had him on my sheet.
We're fed up with him. No more.
Okay. I thought he hadn't resigned quite yet. But Representative Vogel?
No.
Representative West?
No.
Chair Garofalo?
Pass.
Representative Metza?
Pass. Being 11 ayes, 8 nays, and 2 passes, the motion prevails. Members, the next amendment is the A16 amendment. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a document if you could have passed out as well.
Yeah.
So I have the pages passed out, please. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I want to thank you for working with me on this amendment. This is an amendment that deals with the issue of childhood lead poisoning. It's what's left of an original bill that actually did not have a hearing in this committee, but deals with helping us assess what the situation is with the children who are exposed to toxic lead in their housing. And let me just point out as you get this document that I'm passing out, this is a very serious issue. Childhood lead poisoning is a toddler's disease. And every year in Minnesota, we have between 700 and 800 700 and 800 children who are permanently disabled by their exposure to toxic lead in their homes, and it's a totally preventable disease, as we talk about it with the health department and others, and we have some resources that we've been dealing with over the year. I've worked with the Landlords Association, Minnesota Housing Minnesota Multi-Housing Agency, to come up with a language here, and I've worked with the advocates who have brought this bill to me and to some of you. And what we have is a bill that says that we will invest $380,000, which is, thank you, Mr. Chairman, what was left on the bottom line. I really appreciate your help with that. And to actually help both tenants and landlords find out if there's toxic lead in their homes. They'll be testing the paint, the water, and the soil. And as some of you know, this is a situation where we had lead allowed in our gasoline and in our paint until 1978. And as I pointed out, this is really a ongoing and very serious problem. The document that you should have now, maybe before you, does point out that I guess it was 826 children in Minnesota in 2016 were lead poisoned, and we don't really have a universal testing that's required, but we can allow our property owners and our tenants to use the resources that we're providing here. One of the things to know is that in preventing this poisoning of our children, we're going to save at least $100,000 per year. That's what is estimated the cost is, in special education and health care costs and so on. So it's a really good investment. And, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if there's any questions that people might have, but this is a situation that we have all across our whole state. And what the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association asked me to do with this bill is to target it. So it's targeted based on area median income. And so I guess I would just ask members' support and be glad to answer any questions. There may be somebody in the audience if you want to have testify about support. If not, then we can just go forward.
Thank you, Representative Clark. And I do want to say thank you for working with me and thank you for working with stakeholders on this. There is no pro-lead constituency. No one wants this out in their system. It's a matter of how we resolve it. But that money was left on the bottom line for you to design a program, and you did do that. So I would urge members that we vote in favor of and adopt the A16 amendment. Seeing no additional discussion, all those in favor of the A16 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you,
Senator Clark.
Mr. Chairman and members.
Members, next on our list is the A18 amendment. This is an author's amendment. It does, number one is it includes House File 1119, which is on the General Register. It passed out of this committee actually twice, because it went to the General Register last year, and then during the interim we sent it back. I'm aware of no opposition to it, so I'm including that. It also includes House File 3948 of Westville, which, Representative West, if you want to elaborate on it more, there's no opposition to this. The Department of Public Safety has stated they need statutory authorization to allow this to take place. Again, we're aware of no concern. So because it involves the transportation of modular housing is why it's in this committee. And then House File 4394, we have been told there have been consensus in the language. There was going to be a language to delete this language and replace it with a consensus language. Thus far, stakeholders have been unable to reach consensus, so that language is being deleted from the bill. Beyond that, there is just technical language with regards to what's in the bill. Is there any discussion to the author's amendment, the 18 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Representative O'Neill, the A4 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This deletes out the telecommunications Article 7. It was a bill 3497, and I'd like to move that amendment, the A4.
All right. So Representative O'Neill moves the A4 amendment, and again, in testimony, in order for this bill to go forward, we needed to have a hearing scheduled, and it sounds like that hearing is not taking place. So seeing any discussion, seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative West, the A11 amendment.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A11 amendment conforms to some Senate language that they inserted into the manufactured trust provisions, and they're agreed on by all parties.
All right, so this is consensus language with no opposition. Is there any discussion to the A11 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. That one's done. Representative Metza, are you offering the A15 amendment?
Does it have the support of the chair, Mr. Chair?
It does not. Not at this time. Oh, did you pull it already? You did? Okay. I'm sorry. I got old notes here. Representative Fabian, the A19. So, again, Metza does not offer the A15 amendment. I'm using old notes. So, sorry. Representative Fabian, the A19 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A19 is relative to the discussion that we had about some of the wind. The Municipal Utilities Association and some others contacted me and asked me for this amendment to bring it forward, simply clarifying that in order to be able to put more power into a system, you need to make an agreement. And this is just simply going to make sure that the current agreements are adhered to. And if you want to produce more and sell more, you have to have a new agreement.
And members, my understanding is that this is consistent with the wishes of the stakeholders in this, recognize these are highly technical maneuvers, so in the event that there's some corrections that need to be made, it would not surprise me not going forward, but I would urge members to adopt the Fabian Amendment. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Howe, the A12 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, this amendment would restore the deed programs of MIF and JCF funds. This would be done by realigning the money in the bill, and it stays within the committee's target. These funds are used by communities all over the state for economic development. These funds have helped make huge private investments in our communities, and they are highly effective in making redevelopment possible. I could list the numerous examples of how these funds have helped communities and businesses successfully expand in our state, but I believe you heard some yesterday and you've heard testimony in the past, so I'm not going to do that. Mr. Chair, these funds, I think, are used very wisely. I wish that we could put that money back, but I know these funds have been redistributed to a number of great projects. So I'll withdraw the amendment, but would ask if there are additional funds, if they become available, please restore these funds as much as possible. So, Mr. Chair and members, I withdraw the A12 amendment.
Representative Howell withdraws the A12 amendment. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Howell, I agree with the principle of your amendment, and I am grateful that you withdrew it, because it really cut to the quill a number of really good projects. But the principle that the MIF and Job Creation Fund are being rated and degraded as the years go on is you know, we don't do much for economic development in this state. We are in the back of the pack in terms of trying to develop better businesses in the state as compared to Iowa, Nebraska, Wisconsin, Texas. I can name them all. And we should have figured ways to increase this and help the state and expand what MIF and job creation does. Multiple states do investment in R&D. We don't. Multiple states do not have a $1 million limit. We do. And as the reports that this week came out on job and job, the job numbers, we are want to say that our job growth has slowed to about half of what the nation is. The good piece to that is that we grew so fast before, while the rest of the nation lag behind us. This is a committee that should be looking forward on economic development, not sitting on its laurels. And I have a serious complaint to the chair about turning this into an energy committee and not into a jobs committee. I won't go down that path any farther than that. How I appreciate your effort, and I think that it's incumbent upon your party, your speaker, to find more money to restore the dollars to the job creation and the MIF funds. And we should really have a robust, seems though that's such a great word we're using today, discussion about where we want economic development to go in this state, rather than to stay silent on it.
Thank you. So, members, we are not the next amendment now. Representative Howe, this is the A18-803 amendment. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a bill we heard earlier in this committee regarding barns that are being used for weddings. In response to the Thumper Pond building collapse in Fergus Falls last year, we passed a bill requiring those types of buildings to get a building permit from Construction Codes and Licensing Division when they're built in areas that have no local building code enforcement. What this amendment does is it requires those buildings that were historically used for farming and now going to be used for weddings or similar events to get a fire marshal inspection. I've worked with the Hospitality Association, the State Fire Marshal's Office, to limit the scope and to try to minimize the impact to, I didn't want to include the Chi-Chi's restaurant and that type of thing, so I tried to really narrow the scope and go after the agricultural buildings that were, that are being repurposed. So in that event, what has to happen is it has to have an occupancy over 100 people. It has to allow alcohol. It's not a lodging house, hospital, hotel, nursing home, school, place of worship, or a Legion or a VFW. So I tried to find a way to narrow this. And it, the other thing, if you're just going to have one event a year, doesn't apply there also. So it allows that... if somebody wants to have one big bash at their in their barn or their in their hog barn or their cow barn, that's an approved event. You don't have to get an inspection by the state fire marshal. So last year, I told the story where I attended a wedding, and it was a brand new building. I walked in there, and it wasn't what I seen that was the issue. It's what I didn't see that was the problem. The exit doors had no panic hardware. There was no fire alarm system, no smoke detection systems, no fire extinguishers, no exit signs, no emergency lights. When my wife and I went in there, we sat right next to the door because I wanted to make sure we were getting out. Ag buildings, when they're built, they don't require a building permit no matter where they're built. They're not constructed as normal assembly type occupancies are built. They're normally used for storing equipment or animals, not people. So the chance of loss of life is pretty minimal. The structural elements are not engineered. They take into no account for snow load or wind load. The snowstorm last week took down two barns that I know of in Wisconsin. If they were full of people, it would have been a big news flash. I think most of us would agree that if a barn is being remodeled into and repurposed into a business, people that go there should have a reasonable expectation of a minimum level of life safety. This amendment would bring those buildings, require those buildings to get an inspection by the state fire marshal to maintain or require a minimum level of life safety standard to prevent the loss of life due to fire or collapse in what should be a joyous event. I've worked with the Hospitality Association and the State Fire Marshal to try and narrow this scope as much as possible. I'm still open to, if this amendment goes on, to to do a floor amendment or an amendment at the Ways and Means to narrow the scope and bring in to make it more acceptable. But, Mr. Chair, that's the amendment.
Any discussion to the amendment? Representative Munson? Oh, I'm sorry, Baker, then Munson. Okay.
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Representative Howell for bringing this forward. I think it's important that I share my story as a caterer, that we do a lot of off-premise catering, and we do a lot of weddings. And I will tell you, the last 4 or 5 years, we're seeing a lot of explosion with barn activities, and I think it's the coolest thing. What has alarmed me, though, as a caterer, is when I am going into barns or locations that are not fit for this, and then when I hear and see people that thought it was such a great idea, and they don't use this barn really for much of anything. They spent a lot of time cleaning it out and getting it ready. They want to put a sign out at the end of the driveway saying, you know, barn for rent. So it covers the multiple use that you're trying to get to, Representative Howe. And for my staff, during that event that was there at the one time we did it, it had to be 100 degrees in that upper level of the loft. It was extremely uncomfortable. My concerns are many that you've already identified. So I think it's identifying the right component is that if all of a sudden it looks like a business venture and it wasn't built for that, it has to be looked at a little differently when they put a sign at the end of the driveway saying, barn for rent. It isn't just for your daughter that wanted to always have her wedding at this barn because that's the family home site. This is a little different, and I appreciate your work on this, and I will support this. Thank you.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to talk about some of the concerns that I have about this amendment. Last year we fixed up a barn for a wedding reception, and cleaned it out and had a great event there. Certainly was not up to state code because state code doesn't apply to farms in our district. There's a long list of items that would have to be fixed and bring it up to state code if we were to rent out the barn for that purpose. But this, I guess if a barn was to be used for this on a farm site, that owner of that barn is going to be liable for any injury that would occur. And so they're going to reach out. If this is going to be a legitimate business, they're going to have to call an insurance agent and get an insurance policy that would cover that specific use. I've talked to insurance agents in my district, and most of the insurance agents would come out and inspect that property for use for its purpose. And if it doesn't have fire alarms, then they wouldn't offer the policy. The insurance industry is going to protect their liability, and they will come up with a list of requirements to make that barn compliant. Farmers nowadays don't want to have this extra liability that they could lose their farm. If there's a bad, you know, a trip and fall that happens on the farm during an event, so I don't support this because the implementing statewide building codes to every township in the state would bring a large burden on people on their businesses. And this amendment was written for a specific purpose for barns. If people built a barn to code and invested all of the money they needed to invest to bring it up to code, I can see how their business plan now would require that they have to charge a lot of money for this event in order to make it worthwhile. And if they're upset that other people are renting out barns for a fraction of the cost, this bill would look to protect their business and their interests. But it's to spend $500,000 fixing up a barn to bring it up to everything, you know, all the statewide building codes would be really expensive, and it would prevent people from getting into this business. I'd like to ask Representative Howe a few questions about the bill to understand its intent, and I would like to start on line 1.17 of the amendment, where it says that the place of accommodation means publicly or privately owned building historically used for farming. Who determines and what's the purpose of this? Is it just you're looking at if it's a barn, if it was always used historically for farming, or what if it was never used for farming? Whose burden is that? Is it the owner, or is it the state inspector to make the decision on whether that building had been used for agriculture, used for farming?
Representative Howe. Representative Howe, it's up to you if you want to take questions now or if you want to wrap these up in a summation statement. That's your decision.
I'm not afraid of a few questions, but, you know, I think you can take a look at a building and you know whether it's an ag building, built as an ag building, agriculture building or not. There's a pretty distinct line on whether the building was built to a building code, because I will say that this amendment does not enforce the state building code statewide. What this does is it applies the state fire code statewide. And there, when the state fire code goes out, there's an existing building section. So it does not bring them up to new code. What this does is brings them up to a minimum level of life safety. So just to give you a little bit of information on how that works, is the state fire code and state building code work differently. So.
So, Representative Munson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to clarify, in the fire code, it's not just about putting a smoke detector and a fire extinguisher. This is about emergency lighting and commercial doors that would open out, and that such. Is that correct?
Representative Thal.
Definitely. Means of egress, emergency lighting, depending upon the occupant load would all, and this, if they're over 100, it would drive all those emergency lighting, exit signs. I don't know about a fire alarm system. I'd have to have a plan and look up exactly what all would be required as far as a fire alarm system. But it would at least drive in the minimum things that would get people out in an emergency.
Representative Munson.
And would that also apply to having a building sprinkled, installing sprinklers?
Representative Howe.
Not an architect. I am a building official. I'd have to open up the, it depends on the client. I'd have to take a plan and look at it. But depending upon it, it could require that. As it's an existing building, it just kind of depends on what all is in there and how that's all done. But it may require sprinklers, but not all of them would have to be sprinkled. There's different levels that would drive that issue.
Representative Munson.
And I noticed that schools are called out in line 121, but it sounds like that's only if it's being used as a school. If somebody in my district, there's several small towns that had old schools that people had purchased for renovating into different purposes, and these towns are small enough that they have not implemented statewide building codes. If someone were to hold an event in an old school, would it also require that they bring that up to state fire code as well?
Representative Howe.
Well, Representative Munson, I know that certain people call kids animals, but I don't believe they actually qualify as a per unit in the ag business, so no, they'd be out.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Munson.
And to that point, on line 1.19, it says that if these buildings would have to be designed for occupancy by 100 or more people. If it was designed as a barn, it would be designed for holding livestock and not people. So wouldn't barns be exempt under this?
Mr. Howe.
Representative Howe. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, what in that respect, when you, as you... In this terminology, when you design your new occupancy from a barn to a place of a public accommodation, that's when you're saying it's designed for an occupant load of more than 100. So if half of the building is kitchen and half of it is storage and the occupant load is less than 100, that's where the design comes in. So okay, that's the difference in that terminology.
And it's a follow-up question to when you mentioned storage. On line 1.18, it says that the building has to be principally used for wedding receptions or similar social events. If my barn, if I was to use my barn to store RVs for 7 months out of the year, or in this case, 9 months out of the year since our winter's going so long, wouldn't then the principal use of my barn be for storing RVs if I'm storing it for 9 months out of the year and I hold weddings for 3 months out of the year?
Representative Howell.
I would say your principal use is multi-use. That's where I would deem that if you're going to use it for both purposes, I'd probably claim it's probably a multi-use facility. So that would be one of those, that'd be a good question. But it depends on how you design it. And if you're going to design the building to do both, then I would say its principal use is multi-use, and it would probably fall under this. So it's, but that's a good question.
Okay. Representative Munson.
I'm obviously have reservations about this, and I'm going to be voting no, but I think that it's a slippery slope to start with just this very narrow place. We have a lot of, you know, wineries and breweries in our district and on-farm wineries that are using their facility in a barn, and they may host an event, and whether it is a wedding or what's noted here as similar receptions, I think that this statewide code is going to be applied to more and more businesses, and when one of my counties, Blue Earth County, that I represent, looked at implementing statewide building code, they received a lot of backlash from businesses that were not, you know, ADA compliant, you know, a seed salesman out in the country. Now, I mean, there's a lot of building codes that don't apply to people that live in the country or in towns smaller than 2,500 people, and this to me is an expansion of, you know, government that I cannot support, so I'm going to be voting no on the bill. Thank you for answering the questions.
Representative Neuberger, then Mahoney. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Howell, for bringing this forward. I do support this. One of the principal aims of government is to protect its people. And I like the way that this bill targets people that are simply trying to use this as a business, not as the private use, as you talked about, that those folks would be exempt. Now, I have 19 townships. I have a district that's full of barns. And if anyone's ever seen a barn fire, people know that once a barn starts to burn, it goes hot, it goes fast, and it's usually over before you know it. If this was a barn, this room right here, I did a quick count. We got about 80 people. We got 4 exits. If we locked 3 of them, and this was a barn, and this thing started on fire, and half the people in this room had been enjoying themselves with cocktails, how many would make it out that door if this thing started on fire? I hate the guess. So my point being, Representative Howe, is thank you for bringing this forward, because God forbid somebody starts renting their barn out this summer, and there's a fire, and people that are just having a good time end up being killed. The outcry is going to be, what the hell? You guys heard this. You guys heard this bill. You had a chance to do something about it, and you chose not to. So I will be voting yes. Does it need some work? Yeah, it does. But I'm glad we're moving forward on it. Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, too, will be voting yes on this. This is a relatively narrow crafted bill, and I too was in a barn, and I kind of chuckled when the author of the amendment talked about sitting next to the door. I too sat next to the door for that particular reason. This narrowly crafted amendment is a good idea. If you're going to have a business of renting out an accommodation space for 100 people or more, you're making a living at it, and you should be subject to the fair requirements that every other business is set to. So I think this is a good amendment, and I hope it goes on.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, I don't support the amendment. I think that there is some work to do. I appreciate what Representative Howell is trying to do, and probably would encourage withdrawing the amendment just to keep on working on some of the issues. Thank you.
Representative Munson.
Just a couple of follow-up questions to what Representative Mahoney said, that this would only apply to what other businesses are faced with complying with, and that's not true. This doesn't apply to the other businesses in the district. It's just this one specific type of business. If the rest of the county doesn't enforce these rules, but I also had a follow-up question on line 120, where it says serves alcohol. I'm assuming that these 4 items have to all this barn would have to be principally used for wedding, designed to occupy 100 or more people, serve alcohol, and is not one of these places that are called out. Is that correct, that it has to have all 4 together?
Representative Powell.
Well, Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Munson. Actually, it has to hit the other three. If it's number four, it's not doesn't apply to them. So it's actually it has to do all three of those. So if they don't serve alcohol, they don't have to get a state fire marshal inspection. So we, in that respect, I figured if they have all their faculties, they got a good shot at getting out of there. But if they're had a few cocktails, they probably aren't quite aware of what's all going on. So that's why they can actually have their facility do wedding dances and whatever else they want to do. But as long as they don't allow the alcohol to be on there, they'd probably not get a state fire marshal inspection.
Well, I'm sad to see that there's discrimination against Mormons having celebrations, but I just also wanted to make sure that by this understanding, then BYOB and self-serve alcohol would still be allowed. It's not that they have to actually serve alcohol.
Representative Powell. No, actually, it's actually, you know, and if that's what needs to be done, we may change that to allows alcohol. So that's probably one of those changes that I'll probably need to make. So
okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep, Representative New.
I apologize. I had to step up for another committee. Just a quick question, hopefully, Representative Howe. Do you know? I mean, as a building inspector, are there other businesses that are currently not subject to building inspections, or is this barn situation sort of unique in that it was built for another purpose and therefore exempted and is sort of being grandfathered into this exemption currently?
Representative Howell.
Well, if it's in the building code is required to be enforced in any community over 2,500, a population to over 2,500. If you're outstate, let's say if you're building a house, there is, if you're a residential building contractor, you're supposed to build it to the residential building code. The problem is with the lack of inspections and enforcement out in those rural areas, the chances are it's probably not. But this does not go to enforce building codes. You'll see that if you go out, there's a statute that requires hotels, motels to be inspected every 3 years by the state fire marshal. They can be constructed without a building code. But the state fire marshal comes in and requires minimum life safety. They go up to resorts. They do resorts. They do a lot of different places get a state fire marshal inspection. Doesn't mean that they were built to the building code. So this just, you know, as we've seen the wedding barn thing pop up, it looks like this is something that we're going to have a lot of people in a building that wasn't designed for this, and that's why we've targeted the wedding barn situation right now. I mean, it's when you heard the testimony from the folks that have gone out and looked at these things, they actually, some of them prohibit certain songs from being played by the musicians or the DJs, because when people start to dance on the floor, it actually moves the floor enough that they have issues and concerns with the structural integrity. So that's why we need to go out and take a look at it.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarification. I'll be honest and torn on this bill because I see the safety concerns for sure. I'm also a little concerned that perhaps we are regulating them then in a way that other facilities will not be regulated. So I'm torn, to be honest.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Quickly, I had some concerns also, but again, it's a safety issue, and I like the addition that if I want to have a barn dance once a year, that there's the exception for that. So I, too, support the bill.
Any additional discussion? Seeing none, Representative Howell renews his motion to have House on the amendment to pass. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
No.
The motion does not prevail. The next amendment is the 820 amendment.
Division.
The chair did rule on it already, Representative Mahoney.
We can only ask for division after a ruling. Mr. Chair, we can only ask for division after a ruling. You don't hear the vote and then ask for the division before a ruling has occurred.
Now, the way it works, Representative, is first of all, there's a vote. After the vote, a person can call for a division. The chair can make the ruling. Before he hits the gavel, you can make the ruling. But once the gavel falls, the gavel falls. But I guess if it's a real big deal to you, you can push the issue and we'll do a division. That's what you want. But just procedurally, once the gavel falls, that's when the ability to call a division ends. But you're really going to push it? It's up to you. I got a funny feeling the amendment's not going to pass if we do a division. So
I have that feeling too, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So the next amendment is the A20 amendment. Members, this is the wireless carve-out from the bill. What it is 5% of the appropriation for broadband, $750,000 goes to that. What it does is up to $300 of the installation costs, up to half the cost, $300 may use for the satellite installation, and then a monthly monthly subsidy for only 1 year of $50 a month. So a grantee would receive no more than $900 for access to high-speed Internet. This would only be available in unserved territories in the state of Minnesota. And I offer this amendment if there's any discussion on the amendment. Representative News, Lehman and Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sure it is no surprise that I don't support the amendment. And I would just suggest that I live in a very underserved area, and so I've looked extensively into the different satellite options, and I just have concern about the satellite options. I certainly appreciate looking at other options. My concern is just that until the satellite companies lift their data caps, it's just not a viable option for most families. Currently, the two main companies, HughesNet and Viasat, have 50 gig data caps, and the average family is using over 200 per month. And so the reality is that means for about a week and a half, we will have good Internet service, and for the rest of the month, I can quote from the Viasat website, once you hit your data cap, there's a disclaimer that it may greatly impair your ability to use the Internet after you hit that 50 gigabytes. And so for that reason, I think that this is just not a tenable option.
Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to say a couple of things about the bill. I was the author of the broadband bill. And the reason I agreed to author it is because it was a big ask. It was, in excess of $51 million, but it was based on a calculation that we had asked the broadband task force to do for us last year. And I think it was actually, maybe it was Representative Mahoney that asked the question. The question was, when are we done with broadband and how much is it going to cost? And I thought that was a good question. And so I think the task force took that seriously, and they calculated that right now there's 252,000 unserved households that will not meet the broadband goals that the state of Minnesota has set. So they figured out it costs a little bit more than $5,000 per connection, $5,500. And they came out with a figure, and then they figured 50% of that, because the broadband program that we're currently using has the state of Minnesota participating at a level of about 50%. And then it subtracted out from that federal funding that's available and came up with a dollar amount. And then they divided that out by four, because they're looking at accomplishing the Minnesota broadband goals, border-to-border broadband, in 4 years. But to accomplish that, they came up with a figure, of $71,482,000 per biennium. So if they received $71 million per biennium in 4 years, they are saying we would meet our broadband goals. And last year, in this biennium, we were able to come up with $20 million. So you subtract $20 million from $71 million, you get $51 million. And that was the ask this year in the broadband goal. we purposely did not include any policy changes We know that we'd like to look at some of those, but we did not include it in the bill because we just wanted to reach the goal. And so we kept it to a funding bill only. And I'm really pleased we had broad bipartisan support, no problem in getting people to sign onto the bill. Looks like we're not going to get $51 million. We're going to get $15 million. But we're really pleased because that's frankly all the general fund money this committee had, and we got all of it. So we're pleased with that. But I also just want to commend the chair for pushing the envelope and pushing the thinking. He's a techie, and I like pilot projects. And we had talked about doing a pilot in northeastern Minnesota, and I would have enjoyed doing that because, as Representative New said, it doesn't work. And at least we could have data to show that it's not quite there yet. I think they're going to be putting, as I talked to the satellite people, it's a lot of money to send, like $1 billion to send a satellite up. But they will be continuing to produce new technology and improve the satellite technology, and I hope that someday it really does work. Right now it doesn't. And I would like to, I'm going to vote against your amendment, Mr. Chair. I like pilot projects, and I enjoyed the opportunity to think about doing something in northeastern Minnesota, but I want to keep the eye on the ball, and that is to get to meet our goals and connect all of Minnesota with fiber. Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Most people, when they are presenting an amendment, can kind of talk to what they're trying to accomplish and how they're going to relay that back to the committee that has jurisdiction. This is a pretty very simple amendment, $750,000 a couple of years. But I don't know what the end results will be from your amendment. I don't know how I would know whether this was this satellite, these satellite users would live up to what Representative New was talking about. You know, they're having trouble with their data limits, or they're not. We don't know. I think one or two of the members have spoken about the idea of reception. So we wouldn't know whether that particular, and I don't know how many people this would serve. So my question, whether they had reception or had problems with trees, barns, whether they're fire code safe or not, or clouds. So good. It may or may not be a good idea. My question would be, how do we know what this $750,000 buys? Did it do a good job? Did it prove something right or prove something wrong? Your amendment is what it is, but I think it misses something when you don't put some way of accounting for whether it's a good idea or bad idea. So I'm likely to vote against this amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hody, and I'll address your concerns in my closing comments. Representative Baker, then Metzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I had a question for the author, and you want to wait for that, but maybe my question would be, as we've worked on broadband for a number of years here, and I think we've been trying to maximize our investments with matching dollars, I'm wondering how these satellite companies are going to be part of that matching program, if you're saving that to your closing comments, but I would like to kind of understand the differences here is that, as I see it, the satellite is already deployed. It's ready to go, and I think in some areas it might be a good option. I like to keep our options open with technology, so I support that concept. But for matching dollars and how they will step in and help reach more people with their investments is what we've been thinking of anyway in the broadband policy. Help me understand the matching, if you wouldn't mind, Mr. Chair.
Sure, Representative Baker, and why don't I'll address that in my closing comments.
Okay. I don't support it because I don't understand the matching part of it. But also, as I see part of the bill here, 3.29 in the section, 50% of the total cost of satellite broadband equipment installed would be used for this too. Most installations in satellite are free already. It's part of the incentive of getting satellite, and so I think a lot of the incentives to sign up are already paid for. The equipment is already there. I think part of broadband is deploying, whether it's wireless, whether it's fiber, other ideas, but I don't see where this investment from the state then needs to be made in this component. And because, again, along with Senator Lehman or Representative Lehman's comments about $15 million, it's tight, but I'm happy with that. I don't want to trim any more out of that if I don't think it's going to deploy more better quality that's there. So with that, I will not be supporting the amendment.
Representative Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of the things I've learned on this committee is you do push the envelope in terms of thinking outside the box. And I've enjoyed that these last 4 years. And I think on broadband in particular, when we're thinking about it, we've got to be focused. There are some areas that will just never realistically have the capability of having a line drawn into their home. And I think the amendment needs a little bit more work, but I think we should be looking at technology from an agnostic point of view in this committee and making sure that we are providing the communities and people who live, at the end of that road, the best alternative. And I think just one thing to clarify that you had brought up, Representative New, was the caps. And I've discussed caps for quite a while in this committee. They exist on your cell phone. They exist on your home internet, unless you're paying for unlimited coverage. They exist everywhere right now. And the companies want you to go over on the cap, so you end up paying. And I think it's a little disingenuous to say that, this is different in that way, because most people aren't paying for unlimited service. I have two internet lines coming in my house. One is a CenturyLink line. One is a Mediacom. And they both have their benefits. I have unlimited service on the CenturyLink, and I pay a premium for that. And the Mediacom just offers a faster internet for streaming and other things that my wife and I enjoy as a younger family and many other families enjoy around the state. But we should be focused in this committee on making sure that we aren't allowing these companies with these state dollars, the federal dollars that were released for matching, to continue capping data on people and limiting their access based on their financial means. Because one thing we can do to allow people to get a little smarter, our kids to learn a little more, is to have them be able to access information at their fingertips, which I appreciate all these companies in the same token being able to offer. But we've got to get rid of the idea of you got to pay to play, pay to learn, pay to search. And that's one thing I hope we can work on with it moving forward. But I am glad that we've got some funding in here. And as always, Mr. Chair, in my closing comments in this, I'd like to really thank you for your work on broadband. I know that you've been a strong proponent of it for many years and enjoy funding it as much as we all do. So thank you.
It's a fact. No one has chief authored more bills signed into law for broadband than Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of comments. I like about this bill is that it offers options. Not everything is going to work for every household. That's one of the things I do like. I like the fact that in the broadband report, they estimate at $5,500 per customer to get everybody hooked up in the state, and this is about $900 per customer. On this is according to what the bill's written. I like that. It's much, much cheaper than putting a line in the ground. And unless, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong on this, but the statute says, 25 down and 3 up. So there is nothing in the statute about caps anywhere. It just says you have to have a speed. You could put the cap at half a gig and it'd still be, half a meg, I guess, not a gig, a half a meg, and it would still fit the statute on the if you put a wire in the ground. So the caps thing is a totally different issue than actually connecting, just being connected to broadband.
Representative New again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to address this idea of caps, and I appreciate that you bring that up, Representative Metza. I think the caps are an issue because a lot of standard internet companies, they'll have caps, but really the caps are like 300 gigs a month. And so in reality, they don't actually impede data usage. I know for my fixed wireless, I do not have data caps for my fixed wireless. And I would just add that the reality is even with satellite, you can get additional data. It's just extraordinarily expensive for the user. So for HughesNet, initially, if you sign a two-year contract, it's $100 a month for 50 gigs of data. If you do not sign that two-year contract, it's $130 a month. Viasat is even more expensive at $150 a month with the two-year commitment. And last year when I looked into HughesNet, I apologize that I did not pull it up right now, but for an additional 25 gigs of data, it was $75. So, I mean, even if, well, you can see how that adds up very quickly. You're up to several hundred dollars a month, even just for 100 gigs of data. So, yes, there are caps in other programs. However, many of those caps are set high enough such that the average family will never hit them.
Representative Munson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I support this amendment. I am in an underserved area. I have fixed wireless, which now doesn't have data caps. My old provider did. But I just want to be clear on the caps. 50 gig for HughesNet. And full disclosure, I used to work for Hughes when they started back in the 90s in California. The 50 gig cap is more data than you would need for doing all of your home health care, all of your kids' homework. The only thing that where we hit the caps is streaming Netflix and Amazon and HBO Go and all these other online programs, you know, basically watching TV. And as a government, we're not in the business of subsidizing people to watch TV. We're in the business of we're pushing this forward so that kids can do homework and people can get access to their doctors and information and the essential needs of people to connect to the internet. We shouldn't be talking about data caps because this 50 gig which is the lowest now. It will always go up from there. It's not going to apply to the things that we were trying to bring people. So I'm a supporter of this bill, and I know that the numbers that have come back on what we've paid to bring fiber to people's houses is just under $6,000 per household. But we went after the low-hanging fruit to start with. These are the largest clusters of houses. As we try to bring internet to people more and more rural, that number is going to go up. I live a mile off of the nearest possible line where they're going to bring it. And for me, it was $11,000 to trench fiber to my house. And I pay over $100 a month for my fixed Wi-Fi. It's a cost of what we need because I need to get access to the internet. But I support this bill. It's a very inexpensive option. And for me, this also bridges the gap for the next few years until these lower non-stationary satellites can be in place to bring super high-speed internet, hopefully without caps, to everywhere in the world. The technology is moving quickly. It's not just the United States that has underserved areas. It's every place else in the world, and we're going to bring satellites. I mean, this is going to change so rapidly, and spending, you know, $1 billion to bring fiber to every household in Minnesota doesn't make sense. This is a great option, and I support it. Thank you for bringing it forward, Mr. Chair.
Representative Baker again.
Thanks again. I just want to be clear that, again, I don't have a big issue with including satellite in our language with our drive to have more options. It's the carve-out of the $750,000 that I don't see the customer getting it. So to Representative Munson's comments, I think you're right. I mean, you have that right now to pick up the Hughes, and you could give them a call, and you could free installation, and you can get this right now. So why are we spending state money to help folks that's available to you now when it's available to you there? That was the whole idea of this process. The problem with that is because of, commercial uses can't really use it because of the caps. And maybe it's not affordable that we wanted to, but our mission here has always been, let's not waste a single state dollar on broadband grants when we have federal dollars coming in through CAF-2. We've got some ACAM money coming in around the corners as well with some smaller technology folks. I just want to make sure that if we're carving out the $750,000 to this, the only people I see winning are the satellite companies because they're the ones who are going to get the money because they're already offering free installation. And so I just want to understand that, and I know the chair will cover that in his closing comments, but I don't mind satellite as an option as long as we don't take it out of our expanding our lines now. That's I just want to make that point.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, which you'll probably cover in your closing statements, but for folks applying for a grant of $300 or $600 to this pot of money, any estimate of the cost to administer the program? And maybe you'll cover that in your closing.
I'll cover that. Thank you. I have your note down right here. I'll cover all the questions. If I miss any of them, come back to me. Representative Howe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my concern is, and I'm hoping this will solve my problem. I would love to be able to put satellite in and have it work for me, because I live in an area that I think is, when you look at the map, it shows that I'm served. The problem is, I'm not. There's three houses sitting in a row that have no access. You go across the highway, they've got cable. You go the fourth house down, they've got CenturyLink. But where I sit, I get it off a silo a mile and a half away, and it's just above dial-up. So I'm interested to see if we're going to use the map to identify who's unserved or underserved. That's one thing, but then how do I get into the mix? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I look forward to your comments at the closing.
Representative Lehman, again.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I don't want to belabor this, but I just wanted to respond. I heard somebody talk about the fact that we should be agnostic in our technology, and I just want to assure folks that we are. The current broadband program is agnostic as it relates to technology. It is firm, however, in its broadband speed goals. And so as Representative Baker articulated very well, the state determined that it was worthwhile to put public money to help communities reach their speed goals. They didn't care what kind of technology was used. Currently, if satellite can reach the speed goals, that would be fabulous, and I hope that we get there at some point. We're not there right now, but just want to make it clear that the current program is agnostic as it relates to technology. Thank you.
Any closing comments before the final words from the author of the amendment? I'll try to crank through all these. Representative New, you made concerns regarding this. Keep in mind that this is limited to only those who are in unserved areas. So if you are a person who has no hope of being in an underserved area or in a served area, these are the people who are – we hear these stories about people who have access to nothing. That's who this pilot project will be focused on. Representative Mahoney, you bring up a valid point. The intent of this is to get service to approximately 1,000 households as a test. I'm not opposed to putting a reporting requirement in there, some sort of feedback to ask people how the service worked for them should this bill be enacted. Representative Baker, with regards to your question, what was your question? So if you look at 3.29 and 3.30, you can see 50% of the total cost of satellite broadband equipment installed at user locations up to $300, or you flip it over, $600 in monthly satellite broadband subscription charges. So we're going to be empowering the, in that situation, there's going to be some flexibility there. What the chair's intent is that this would be a reimbursement program. So when it comes to the idea of matching, obviously the provider has sufficiently matched, has provided any match they could because they spent billions of dollars putting devices in geosynchronous orbit. So that's kind of their match. They've done the capital outlay on the front side. With regards to the family or the household that would be purchasing this, their monthly cost should be at or around that area of $50, so that there's going to have some match in that as well. And this is not in perpetuity. This is just for the first year. And if people have follow-up questions, you can address that with me when I'm done. In terms of whether satellite is ready to go or not, I would just remind people that for over a year, for 18 months now, we've had high-speed internet being provided via satellite. It has been available. Viasat is now up as a competitive satellite option. And we haven't even discussed the option of fixed wireless, which is quickly gaining ground in western Minnesota, southern Minnesota, in those areas where there is line of sight. What we're beginning to find out are these legacy fiber installations that people thought they could put fiber into the ground and everyone would snatch up their service. Now fixed wireless is coming along and offering higher bandwidth at a lower price, and the problem is the trenches have been dug, and the money's already buried in the ground, literally, for that. So we're not even discussing fixed wireless. This is for a narrow subset of users, particularly I would envision in northeastern Minnesota, where they're going to have a few lines of sight because of obstructions, in addition, because it's very difficult to dig in rock or in hard soils, unlike in other parts of the state. It's a pilot project that would reach out to about 1,000 households that I think merits attention and work. With regards to Representative Anderson, the administrative cost of this, should we adopt this amendment, I would expect that we'll get some sort of fiscal note from the Office of Broadband Development, or they may reference a fiscal note to another thing if the Department of Commerce were silent on that language. Representative Baker, did I answer your question and others, or did you have a follow-up? I'm happy to.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I guess part of my concern is that what would be the hurt if you were to remove the money component of this amendment and allow the satellite to be fairly and evenly looked at by the grant process to try to do that? And maybe they with that signal and our intent here is if there should be some of that money going out there, I'm just concerned that we're putting a fixed amount out there that may be larger than it should have been. Maybe it's going to be smaller. But maybe the grant process would actually say in this area, satellite should be looked at. Maybe they've got some new things to look at. But is there a possibility you might want to remove the dollar amount so that we either don't limit this idea or overexpand it that we're forcing it to and not doing, I think, what our intention is meant to do here, Mr. Chair?
So, Representative Baker, the language as it's intended is for a pilot project, so it is a floor and a ceiling. It's only 5% of the overall appropriation. With regards to just eliminating it and having the satellites compete with the existing program, it doesn't work within the existing program. The existing program is project-based, so we're talking about cities or groups of a township or backhaul infrastructure, backhaul communications for a fixed wireless area. The satellite deployment is really for individuals in unserved areas. So this, I envision that an individual who has this problem and is not being served is able to reach out and be served. It's not a matter of a project or a specific geographic area. It's more the unserved area of the whole state. And the existing program just does not, it's not set up for an individual to apply and say, hey, I would like high-speed internet. That's why the set-aside instead of relying on the existing programs. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, so if I'm not a satellite user now, I would be, and I'm in an unserved area, it's really then kind of in your intent, the first 1,000 people that call them up that are not a current user and in an unserved area, they could be eligible for this if it was passed and put into law. The first 1,000 that would call up might be the ones who get this. Is that how that is your intention?
The intention would be to be first come, first serve. Obviously, whether a person is in an unserved or underserved area is not known by every member of the public. Those resources are available. I would expect you'd have some people who would apply and then decide they're not interested. You'd have other people apply, determine that they're actually in an underserved area, they would not be eligible. But that would be the intent, is basically first in, first out.
And, Mr. Chair, would the Office of Broadband then have to take those 1,000 calls and help identify if those are in that region and or not, and who those providers would be then? How will the Office of Broadband be involved in this?
Well, so we have great mapping available that identifies what households are in unserved areas versus underserved areas. Whether they would do that or whether that be something that we would offset to the Department of Commerce to administer the program, I am silent on that in language. I think the Office of Broadband Development may need a little bit of extra money to administer this. We'll look for a fiscal note from them should the amendment be adopted. But generally speaking, we're talking about a very small, very minor pilot project here. The biggest issue I could see was that there would be so much enthusiasm for my new idea to get internet to people at a lower cost than the current program, that maybe that would be taxing. Representative Baker.
I still can't support the amendment.
All right, got it. Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick question. While I'm currently extremely frustrated with our internet provider, I live in an area where of the state where it snows, and so I've never looked at satellite as a legitimate option. But in terms of reimbursing folks for the cost of installation, as I understand on 2.24 to 2.6, if I'm reading, but in that area, Representative Baker brought up the point that usually the equipment is free. That's part of the incentive for purchasing the satellite service. Are Does this then set up a potential situation where we actually encourage the satellite providers to moving from free installation of the equipment to charging for the equipment, and then arguing that you can get the state to cover a chunk of the cost, and it'll actually end up delivering more expensive service to these individuals?
Representative Dabney, my understanding is that there are some installations that are free and some hardware that is free. There certainly are situations where installation and hardware are free. I'm willing to examine that a second time and take another look at it, or maybe have those dollars be repurposed into the monthly side of things. But the intention was to have it be expansive as a pilot project to try it out. Because of the limited, we're talking $750,000 here. We're talking about the potential for about 1,000 households. If that problem were to develop, I think we would identify it fairly quickly. But I don't, right now, my understanding is that you have both those types of sales plans. The problem with the free, those ones that have the free installation, a lot of times they lock them down for 2 years. They have the 2-year service contract. And that may not be, that may be, again, a consumer choice that people are not too excited about. But the intent was to be expansive and flexible, not to be limited and more expensive.
So, thank you.
Any other questions or comments from members of the committee? Seeing none, the chair renews his motion to have the A20 amendment adopted. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
You can call for a division. I don't think you have yet. Did someone say division? All those in favor, please raise your hand. A sufficient number of hands having risen, the motion prevails.
Thank you.
All right, so that is, I believe that's all the amendments. Are there any other amendments members have? Representative Metza. Representative Metza moves the A18 amendment. Just one of the amendments. That's fine. I just need the A18 amendment. Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is something we went over in committee, and Representative Lehman and I have continued to work with the companies and the IRRRB staff and the rest of the range delegation and getting this language tightened up. We're both in support, and we've already gone through the gist of the language in previous testimony, so I guess if there's specific questions, I can answer them. Otherwise, I'll keep it short.
Representative Metz, so just to be clear, this is the amendment would be labeled the A18-0820 amendment. Mr. Weeks, is that correct?
A18-0820, correct.
Yes, okay, so members, if you haven't had it yet, A18-0820. I'll just give members a minute to find that. Representative Metza, you can did you complete your introduction of the amendment, or do you want to elaborate on it?
I'm happy to if there's more questions. Otherwise, we have gone through it. So.
Representative Lehman?
Mr. Chair, I thank you. I likewise support the amendment. As Representative Metza said, I guess I can elaborate a little bit. The amendment in part already passed this body, and it involved a one-time transfer of funds within the agency itself. What was added was a little bit of change to the language in a program that reimburses taconite plants some portion of their production tax for reinvestment in their plant and equipment. And so at first the language was not completely agreeable to the industry. It is now. And so the amendment that's coming to you is an expansion of one you looked at earlier in the past. Thank you.
And Representative Lehman and Representative Metzen, does this amendment have any general fund impact on the state general fund?
Mr. Chair, it does not.
Representative Metzen?
Mr. Chair, she is correct.
All right. And then Representative Lehman, Representative Metzen, are you aware of any stakeholders or constituency groups in this taconite service territory that are opposed to this amendment? Representative Lehman?
I am not, Mr. Chair.
Representative Metza?
I am not, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any additional discussion from members of the committee? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Are there any other amendments members wish to adopt or propose?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Baker.
The amendment A18-0811 was posted yesterday as well. I just wanted to bring it up today to remind members, this was brought to us by Representative Miller, talking about Gopher State One Call and a very important meeting that happened with contractors last August. In the desire and the need for actual working phone numbers when there's a problem in the field. And we have some contractors in our district that Representative Miller and I share that have a lot of concerns that Gopher State has not done a good job, and the group of folks have not done a good job over the past few years about keeping that number list accurate. And I think the conversation is going well. I do appreciate Gopher State One Call putting out a letter at the end of March, letting folks know they're going to actually, they are working on this very hard right now. They're putting together some good information, and they'll have that out in April. So I want to withdraw the amendment, Mr. Chair, but I want to let members know that there is concern still from the contractors that they want to see it to believe it, and they also want to make sure that what works this summer is working well. So this may come up next year if we don't find the end result how they want to see it. I just want to really give members a heads up on that, but I am withdrawing the amendment, but I want to make sure that we put a call out to say we are serious about making this fix next year if it's not done. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Baker withdraws his amendment. Is there any other amendments the members wish to offer? Seeing none, Representative Metza, I see you're...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
...apprehensive and undecided, Representative Metza.
Well, you just looked... You had said not yet, so I thought if you had considered on the A-15, it, to my knowledge, also does not have any general fund impact and would be a good project to expand our solar reach in northeastern Minnesota.
But you're not actually offering the amendment, though, are you?
Mr. Chair, I'd leave that up to you. It would be really good for you to offer that for northeastern Minnesota.
So I did not hear you offering the amendment, so we'll move on. Is there any other amendments for members of the committee? Discussion on House File 4289 as amended. Otherwise, I'm just going to, Representative Mahoney, I'm going to have you give the closing comments on the DFL side. I'll give the closing comments on my side, but is there any other discussion? Representative Mahoney.
Well, this is going to be an early afternoon, which is always good. Always good. You know, I want to congratulate you, Mr. Chair. I've been on this committee with you for what seems like forever, but I want to congratulate you. The letters from the departments. I think the first year there was something like 109 objections. The second year it was down into the. Double digits the third year. I think last year it was like 59. And this year it's down to just about 20, I think, or something like that. So you're doing better. You're doing better. But there are still some concerns with this particular bill and the committee as a whole. And I mentioned that earlier, that this is devolved into a energy committee and really no focus on how we build an economy in the state of Minnesota other than, you know, what is energy. And that's a concern for me. We have, well, I'll go over some of the issues that I think are the issues that we should be looking at. You know, you took out substantial funding from the Minnesota Investment Fund, Job Creation Fund, basically hamstringed it. It's a very ineffective, it will be a very ineffective program once your cuts are put into place. And the money that was left in there, you earmarked. And I thought one of the screeches that was done pretty consistently by the GOP, both federally and state, was we should never earmark, we should never earmark, we should never earmark. But then again, there's many things in the GOP that have changed lately. You put in, the legislature has to approve building codes. We've had that argument. You know where almost every building official stands, where the department stands, where the governor stands. He threatened to veto the bill over that last year. your broadband $15 million, you know, you should be proud that you have passed the most bills on broadband. You should be, and the people in greater Minnesota should be frustrated that it never quite reaches to the level that will make a huge difference. $15 million, at that rate, we'll be here doing this for a very, very long time. You put in a tip penalty into this particular bill. Rather than look for a creative solution to this particular problem that would get around the surly court decision, you decided to use a hammer and just take money from people who are just trying to make a living. And if you think, and you use the argument that they're going to lose jobs because they're going to go to counter service. And I just heard somebody, I can't remember who it was, that talked about the technology of tomorrow changing rapidly. Well, restaurants are going to change also. And whether you have a tip penalty or not, they are going to go to counter service. The restaurant industry is looking for ways to cut costs because consumers are saying that they're not as interested in fine dining and paying $100 a meal. It's just going to happen whether it has a tip penalty or not. You know, I know the governor has some concerns with your PUC issues and the movements. I won't talk too much about that because in some ways I think the PUC needs to be more flexible and more mobile and faster. I'm not sure why we're moving the PUC to Virginia. Seeing how that's going to increase costs, and you have been, and my colleague sitting next to me continues to whisper in my ear about how much we need to reduce this government spending or spend it more wisely. I won't go too far along that one. We've got preemption in this bill with rent control. Got some good provisions in the bill. I will give you that. The wage theft, and you know, I know in your heart, this really irks you that we even have to enforce wage theft, because you know that I know that you believe that if somebody's worked 8 hours a day, they should get paid for 8 hours. I wish the Greater Minnesota Business Development monies was more, because it's a well used piece for Greater Minnesota, and urban Minnesota. I know this bill is going to Ways and Means and then going to get, as I understand it, going to get wrapped into a number of other bills and presented on the floor or wrapped into one big one. Or at least that's the hot rumor in at the legislature. So I'm not going to use all my angst over this bill until it gets to the floor or when it gets back from conference committee. But one thing that irritates me on a more personal note is you have in here, you're giving $400,000 for a website, for billboards. For one, most of the kids nowadays are not looking at websites, they're looking a little bit more specifically at social media and how that blends into their ideas. And for God's sakes, I don't even look at billboards, and I'm a lot older than a high school kid. I try to block them out nowadays. But what really gets me is that just in my local, because I can really only check into the numbers for a variety of reasons, into what my local, Pipefitters local, 1,500 members, spends on outreach. We alone spend $2 million a year on outreach trying to get to kids. That's just one. That doesn't include the boilermakers or the carpenters or the laborers or anyone else. That doesn't include what we spend on training. Every member in my local that works spends $1.22 above and beyond that $2 million to train kids. And if you take the numbers and you run them out, $1.22 an hour, and you round it at $2,000, that's about $2,500 a year that comes out of my paycheck to train kids and to do that outreach. And you've got $400,000 for two of the most ineffective ways to reach young people into your bill for merit shops, for the non-union. It's obvious that the non-union is not willing to invest money in recruiting. They want us, the taxpayers, to pay for it. That's a personal issue to me. And if for no other reason, for whatever else you put in this bill, I would vote against this bill for that particular piece. You continue to speak to a level playing field. Your bill picks winners and losers. It earmarks things. It spends money unwisely. You may have a different version of what's unwise than I do, and that's fine. You don't really try to set the economy for the next 5, 10, and 25 years. We should always have a plan that both Republicans and Democrats can agree on, and we can move forward, not with a state-run economy, but a state-run plan that helps businesses of innovation come to this state, find employees, prosper, and grow here. This bill doesn't do that. This bill spends way more time, way more, pardon the pun, energy on energy than it should. Although I do want people to understand that I know energy is an important piece. So, Mr. Chair, you know, you're down to 22 poison pills in your bill, or 23, I think, somewhere in that neck of the woods. I'm sure we're going to actually see a real bill probably 3 or 4 days before we adjourn, like we do every year. And it'll be done behind closed doors or with 4 people or 6 people, and then it'll be presented to us to vote up or vote down. You've got bills in here that we should have at least heard so that when the real bill comes, we have some idea. It's frustrating to sit through this, put a bill out like this that doesn't do enough for the state of Minnesota, and know that your plan is to get it vetoed by the governor, and then 4 days before the end of session, we're going to get a bill from Representative Dowd. Very frustrating. But I think the day is young, so I think I can go find something to do at home.
Thank you. And my apologies to Representative Scott Baker. I know that you're on the list now, but I did kind of prompt. I do prefer to give the minority lead the second to last word before the chair, so we can speak after committee or on the floor, or Representative Baker, where and ways and means. So I do want to once again thank all the staff members who put so much work into this committee. It truly is an honor being the chair of this committee. And, you know, we might be having a meeting after this or not, but in case we don't, you know, every year is different. You have some members leave. People move on and do other stuff. But I just want to thank the members of the committee and thank the members of the staff for the opportunity to chair this committee. And again, to our staff, who, if you think it's difficult being a legislator serving with me, imagine what it's like staffing me. So, just a couple of thoughts on the bill before we move on today. First of all, the state of Minnesota currently has a 3.2% unemployment rate. Throughout this year, as well as last year, it was the will of the committee that dollars, rather than being spent on subsidies to create job creation or incentives to create job creation, were better invested in people and in individuals. That's why we put additional money. We took money from those two large programs and put them into things like the job training grants that Representative Rarick was carrying. That's why we took that money and we put it into things, some of Representative Mahoney's proposals regarding LSI and leveraging contractors. It's why we put money in Representative Mariani's bill for the CLUES educational facility they're building out to help reduce the disparities. We also recognize that current events dictates we sometimes need to be flexible and respond. That's why we included part of Governor Dayton's proposal for the Duluth paper mill. It's also why we recognize the fact that the up in Mille Lacs where there was a government-created problem, that government should be part of the solution up there and trying to rebuild their economy from the devastation that has occurred as a result of a lack of tourism from the walleye restrictions. That's also why, on a bipartisan basis, we included some wastewater infrastructure projects in here. You can have the most trained workforce in the world. You can have the greatest economy, but if you can't flush the toilets, you ain't going to have any jobs. And so that's why, on a bipartisan basis, we included that in there. I want to thank Representative Barr for his work, as well as the Prairie Island Indian community. We have an opportunity this year to not only save ratepayers hundreds of millions of dollars over the years ahead by reducing those dry casks, basically the tax on nuclear power, but also to have a nation-leading and world-leading facility for clean energy down in the Prairie Island Indian community, where we've made a commitment of $40 million over the next 5 years. It gives us a worldwide opportunity to demonstrate not only clean energy but also storage, and it's one that, candidly, I am exceptionally excited about. We also are taking steps to recognize that affordable housing means different things to different people. There's a lot of manufactured homes and modular homes in the state of Minnesota that are reaching the end of their life cycle and need a little bit of an incentive in terms of grants to keep them up and running. These mobile home parks provide a lot of housing in a lot of parts of our state, and I want to thank Representative West for his policy and appropriations work on that measure to make sure that we can, for pennies on the dollar, preserve affordable housing instead of heavily subsidizing other areas of the budget. There's been talk about that we didn't hear bills. Again, every single bill that was before us today has had 3 days of hearings, today, yesterday, and 2 days ago. So everything that was brought forward that did not have an individual hearing on that has been noticed, has been discussed, and has had an opportunity for significant public input as well as from members of the public. And last and finally, as this bill moves forward, what I see is more options for affordable housing. I see cheaper and cleaner energy. And most importantly, what I look forward to as this bill goes forward is I hope that we can be an opportunity to negotiate these provisions with the individual commissioners from the governor's office for a clean and orderly end of session. And so I look forward to working with each of the commissioners. It's an off year, so I just don't think it's that. Unlike the stress of a budget year, I think we can bridge our differences and address each other's concerns as we go forward. So with that, the chair renews his motion to have House...
Roll call, Mr.
Chair. A roll call has been requested. The chair renews his motion to have House File 4289, as amended, be recommended to pass to the Committee on Ways and Means. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Grofflow?
Yes.
Representative Neuberger? Representative Mahoney?
No.
Representative Clark? Representative Wagenius? Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Barr?
Yes.
Representative Baker?
Aye.
Representative Dabney?
No.
Representative Fabian?
Yes.
Representative Howe?
Aye.
Representative Lehman?
Yes.
Representative McQuaid? Representative Metza?
No.
Representative Moran? Representative Munson?
Aye.
Representative New?
Yes.
Representative O'Neill?
Yes.
Representative Rarick?
Yes.
Representative Scott?
Aye.
Representative Sundin?
Yes.
Representative Vogel?
Yes.
Representative West?
Aye.
There being 15 ayes and 5 nays, the bill is passed as amended and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Members, we do have one more bill on the agenda. That's what we discussed before. This is the O'Neill bill. Representative O'Neill moves. Representative O'Neill moves House File 3708 be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. Representative O'Neill, is there any change to this language that was not amended onto the omnibus bill?
No, Mr. Chair. I would like to make sure that the full language that was amended onto the omnibus bill is the same language that will be in the 3708. And I apologize. I did not draft an amendment to that effect. I I misunderstood when we had the informational hearing. I thought we had adopted my DE, and it looks like we did not. So.
Okay, so Representative O'Neill, here's what I'm going to do. Is first of all, I usually make a motion on the omnibus bill that I didn't, that I could maybe do retroactively now, and that is to give nonpartisan staff the ability to follow the intent of this committee to make technical adjustments as necessary to reflect the will of the committee today. I don't know if we need to vote on that or if that instruction is good enough. That's good enough, isn't it? Okay. So, Representative O'Neill, first of all, we're going to go back to your amendment then. And if you could tell me what your amendment is, I'm going to find it and tell me if this is okay.
The A14, Mr. Chair.
All right. So what I'm going to recommend is that House staff be instructed to direct – is the A14 amendment?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
That the A14 amendment be comprised as a delete-all amendment to House File 3708 and that we give instructions to staff to make the necessary title and language adjustments to make that true. So this is the identical language that was in your amendment language that –
Yes, Mr. Chair. Okay.
So on that amendment, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All say nay. Motion prevails. So now the bill is in the form that you would like, Representative O'Neill, and the chair will then move that House File 3708 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Members, with that completes our agenda for the day. Stay tuned. We may be having informational hearings in the future. With that.